Welcome to Hub Dialogues, a podcast that celebrates the big thinkers and bold ideas that are driving the public conversation. On Hub Dialogues, you'll hear the Hub's editor-at-large, Sean Spear, in conversation with some of the world's sharpest minds and brightest thinkers about the issues and ideas that they're passionate about and that they think we should spend more time focusing on. The Hub's podcasts are generously supported by listeners like you. Visit thehub.ca to enroll now as a free member. Members get access to the Hub's best content and analysis, including original news reporting, commentary, and yes, lots more podcasting. Visit now, www.thehub.ca.
Welcome to Hub Dialogues. I'm your host, Sean Spear, editor-at-large at The Hub. I'm honored to be joined today by Chris Reagan, the founding director of the Max Bell School of Public Policy at McGill University and a past guest of Hub Dialogues. Chris is a leading economist who's published dozens of books and articles and advised governments on a range of topics, including public finance, monetary policy, and carbon taxes, which will be our topic of conversation. In his role as the former head of the Eco-Fiscal Commission, Chris has made a major contribution to the intellectual environment concerning climate policy and the federal carbon pricing policy itself. I'm grateful to speak with him about the current carbon tax debate, what he thinks it gets wrong, and what our policy options are in a world in which carbon pricing comes to play a smaller role in Canada's overall climate agenda. Chris, thanks for joining us at Hub Dialogues.
Thanks for having me, Sean. Great to be here.
Before getting into the current political debate over carbon taxes, I wanted to start with understanding our policy goals. Some observers, including Hub contributor Trevor Toome, have argued that it would be better if we moved away from climate policy being driven by emissions reduction targets. But the global climate policy regime is predicated on national emissions targets, so for better or for worse, that has come to shape Canadian climate policy. In that vein, Chris, what are our emissions reduction targets? And at this point, all things being equal, what progress are we making towards them?
Well, let me comment, first of all, on the desirability of targets. So if what Trevor means is that we, rather than focusing on targets, we should actually talk about policies and implement policies and make sure they're doing something, I completely agree. I think we in Canada have spent too long talking about targets and actually not introducing policies. I think these days we actually are implementing policies and we're implementing policies to achieve targets. So I think that's a much healthier conversation. If what Trevor means is that we should focus on, you know, the social cost of carbon rather than the quantity of emissions, then I'm not so sure I agree. I think there's probably more uncertainty about this thing called the social cost of carbon than there is about the emissions reductions that we need to achieve. Globally, I think there's a pretty powerful consensus among climate scientists, and I'm not a climate scientist, but my sense is that there's a pretty powerful consensus that the world needs to reduce emissions by something between 80 and 90% from current levels by something like over the next 40 or 50 years. So you could quibble about whether it's 80% or 90% or whether it's 40 years or 50 years, but relative to today, what it means is a huge reduction in emissions. So I think it shouldn't be surprising that, you know, the UN organized discussions are about quantities of emissions. And I don't think it's surprising that we end up sort of talking about what will we do versus what other countries will do. But I absolutely agree that we need to talk about policies and policies that will reduce emissions effectively and at low cost. And I think that's where you're going to go with some future questions. So your actual question there was, what are the targets? Well, our current targets are to reduce emissions by about 40 to 45% below 2005 levels by 2030, okay? And then there's another target, which is to be net zero emissions by 2050. Now, net zero means, well, as the name net suggests, it means that there's, you know, there might be positive emissions in parts of the economy, but negative emissions elsewhere, but they net out to zero by 2050. So those are aggressive targets. Many countries, by the way, have adopted very similar targets. So these are aggressive targets when you look at today's emissions, but this is what the climate science suggests we need to do, globally by something like 2050. So again, don't focus on the target so much as to just say, we need a huge reduction in emissions much quicker than we have been doing it. So let's get to it.
To that vein, just to follow up, based on our current policy framework, how does the picture look relative to those targets?
So my understanding is that today's set of policies in Canada, provincial and federal, don't yet get us. I mean, we are not projecting to achieve the 2030 targets. We're close. We're getting closer, but we're not there yet. And we're certainly not on track to make 2050. And so this is why, you know, the federal government in particular is not just saying, okay, we're done and dusted. Our policies are in place. We're good to go. They're saying, well, you know, we need some more policies. Either we need to ramp up the existing policies or we need more policies. So we can actually come back to that issue, which is, should we ramp up existing policies or should we introduce new policies? That's an important issue.
Of course, one of the key policies that the Trudeau government has enacted is carbon pricing, which I want to take up now because you and others have made the persuasive case that carbon pricing is the most cost-effective way to meet our emissions targets, which is to say that any policy intervention that aims to lower emissions will come with an economic cost, but among the options, carbon pricing carries the lowest cost. What's the key insight here, Chris? Help our listeners understand this point.
So let's make two points. One is, why should this be costly at all? And why is carbon pricing the lowest cost? The reason why it's costly at all is that, you know, Canada and every other country you can imagine has built their economies on energy use, and in particular on the use of fossil fuels. I mean, this has been true over a few hundred years, right? So we've gone from burning coal to, you know, burning oil, gasoline, diesel, et cetera. And the reason we use fossil fuels and have used fossil fuels is that it's incredibly efficient energy source, just incredible. And so if you're going to say, well, 3/4 of emissions come from the burning of fossil fuels, which is about right, which means if we're going to have a massive reduction in emissions, we have to either substitute away from fossil fuel use, or we have to come up with some way to continue burning them, but we capture their emissions. Well, both of those things are just going to be costly. It's going to be expensive to make a transition away from this super efficient energy source to something else, or it's going to be expensive to capture those emissions. So it's just going to be costly. At a minimum, it's going to be costly during the transition period. And maybe 50 years down the road, life will be wonderful. But, you know, transitioning away from a super efficient, low cost energy source is going to be costly. And so you're then to say, well, fine, now what are the options? Well, there's a bunch of different policy options. You can have direct quantitative regulations, you can have subsidies, you can have mixes of those two things, or you can have something like carbon pricing. And a carbon price can be a carbon tax, like we see in British Columbia. It can be a carbon price that is generated from a cap and trade system, like we see in Quebec. You could actually combine them as we used to see in the UK. But in any event, the central attraction to a carbon price, whether it's a tax or a cap and trade system, is that you're actually using the market. And you're using the market in the following sense. The government is saying, we're going to put a price on carbon emissions, but we're not then going to micromanage what happens. So we put a price on carbon emissions, and today the federal carbon price on emissions across the country, or at least in those jurisdictions that have the federal carbon price, which is basically everything other than BC and Quebec, it's $65 per ton. And on April 1st, it's scheduled to rise to $80 per ton. But the government sets that price, and then they say, fine, everybody now, whether you're a household, small business, big business, you do what you want to do. You respond to that price in the way that you see best for your situation. We're not going to micromanage it. And so, Sean, you might make a different decision than me. You might choose to drive differently. Somebody else might choose to heat their house differently. Somebody else might choose to take different vacations. Small businesses might react one way. A cement factory might respond a very different way than a steel producer. And that's the beauty of carbon pricing. It's hugely what we would call flexible. It's not the government reaching in and prescribing what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. They say, we're putting a price on carbon because that's the pollution here that we want to limit. And you respond any way you want. And there's a powerful incentive to reduce your emissions. So if you're a business, there are powerful incentives to come up with ways to keep doing what you're doing, but to do it in a less carbon emitting way. And again, different businesses are going to do different things. And by the way, some businesses might decide, you know what? It's more expensive for me to cut my emissions than it is to just keep on emitting, in which case they pay the price. Okay. And because they're imposing this, their pollution is imposing a cost on the rest of society, which is the essence of climate change, then that's an okay outcome too. Right. But they have an incentive to, and over time, they probably will actually reduce because the price keeps going up. And so it gets more and more expensive not to reduce emissions. So that's the central beauty of a carbon price. Its flexibility is what gives it the low cost characteristic relative to other mechanisms.
Now, well, carbon taxes may be the most efficient emissions reducing policy tool. It's, of course, not the only one that Canadian governments are using to reach our emissions target. We have a mix of policies, including regulations, subsidies, and so on. What's the logic behind a mix of different policies? Is it a prudential judgment about the public's acceptance of the level of carbon taxation needed to meet our targets? Or is there actually a policy argument in favor of the interaction between different policies that justifies such a mix?
Right. So this is a great question. And you're going to get a slightly different answer here from depending on who you talk to. At the Ecofiscal Commission, we wrote a report that had a very boring title called Supporting Carbon Pricing. We should have really worked on that one. But it was a paper that was admitting that carbon pricing can't do it all. But what it was is saying, well, look, that's not just a loosey-goosey argument for do anything you want. Let's actually be precise about identifying what carbon pricing can't do and what kinds of policies actually can complement carbon pricing very well. And in that, we talked about things like the federal methane regulations that at the time were under development, and I think they still are. And you know, and our examination of that was that they were actually very low cost. We could actually reduce emissions with those federal regulations at something like $6 or $7 or $8 per ton. So we thought, well, this is fabulous. And methane, generally, it's methane leaks that are the problem. And that just doesn't lend itself very well to carbon pricing. So to us, that was just a great example of a non-pricing policy, but it really added to the it complemented carbon pricing. So it added to the mix in a very sensible way. But we also did a little case study on Quebec's EV subsidies that are quite generous. And there's lots of good reasons why subsidies tend to be very expensive. Two reasons are, number one, you very often end up paying people for things they would have done anyway, in which case you get no bang for your buck, but you still pay the bucks. And the second thing is that you have to pay for the subsidies by raising tax revenue, and you're probably raising that with some tax that creates damage in the economy. Well, when we did the examination of the Quebec EV subsidies in that ecofiscal report, we found that the emissions reductions were happening as a result of those at $400 per ton. So when you're in a world of a $50 or $75 per ton carbon price, like, it is crazy to be thinking about EV subsidies at $400 a ton. So that those are just two examples of policies, you know, one that we thought was good and one that we thought was pretty bad. You know, we also did a report on blending mandates for ethanol. Well, those are also very expensive. And 25 years ago, when we didn't have a carbon price, maybe mandated blending of ethanol was not a bad idea. But now we've actually, you know, we're in a different world. We've got a carbon price, or at least we do for now, and we have can do the work to realize that the blending mandates are actually very expensive. It was something like $185 per ton. So what I think is that there's an onus. I would hope that there's an onus on policymakers to say, okay, let's recognize that carbon pricing can't do everything, but let's be very careful about the policies we design, because some of them will be very expensive and some of them won't be. And let's just choose very carefully.
I've seen reports that carbon pricing, including both the consumer and industrial price, today represents something like 25 or 30% of our projected emissions reductions between now and 2030. Chris, do you have a sense of the relative share at this point?
So I've seen some numbers recently that actually suggest it's a little higher than that, that the industrial carbon price plus the what's often, you know, the consumer fuel charge adds up to a little bit less than 50 going forward. I think it's been a smaller fraction in the past, but that's partly because the carbon price is at a lower number. So anyway, you know, maybe it's 30, maybe it's 50. Okay. Maybe it's somewhere right in the middle at 40. But to me, no matter whether it's 30 or 40 or 50%, if we imagine a world without that carbon pricing, then what that means is, well, if we're going to replace it with something else, we're almost certainly going to replace it with higher cost policies. And this is, I think this is at the nub. I mean, this really was at the nub of what Ecofiscal was all about. We weren't just talking about policies to improve the environment. And by the way, not all of our work was about climate change and carbon pricing. But we were saying, look, it's not just about good policies for the environment. We should care deeply about the cost of our policies. We live in a world where there are lots of challenges, Sean. And all, addressing all of our challenges, you know, whether it's healthcare or whether it's population aging and those two things are related, or whether it's education or whether it's something else, they require resources to address those issues. They're either coming from the private sector or they're coming from the public sector, which gets its resources from the private sector. And so we need to care about the costs of our policies. And so if we are knowingly introducing policies that cost way more than they need to, like, why are we doing that? And so that's what I worry about.
We'll come back to the consequences of eliminating the carbon tax for Canada's emission targets and what options would be available to policymakers in that scenario. But before we get there, I'd be remiss if I didn't give you a further chance to outline why you think the growing calls to eliminate the carbon pricing regime are wrongheaded. In addition to the economic costs issue that you just outlined, what else are its critics missing?
Well, I guess a couple of points. Let me start at the top of the list, I think, which is most critics of the carbon price aren't suggesting an alternative. You know, so they don't like the carbon price for various reasons, and I can talk about those, but they're not saying policy XYZ would be better, right? Better even in some sense, maybe not a cost sense, maybe some other sense, but they're not suggesting an alternative. And I think if we're going to have a debate about whether you like the carbon price or not, and whether we should replace it or pause it, but you know, most of the critics, of course, would like to just see it gone, then I think there ought to be an onus on them to say, here's our policy proposal and here's why it's better. Here's the sense in which it's better. But we're not hearing that. And the danger of that is, you know, I think we can be forgiven for maybe believing that if they're not suggesting an alternative, maybe they don't have an alternative. Maybe their opposition to a carbon price is really an opposition to doing anything about climate change. And if they really don't care about climate change, I wish they would have the courage, decency to just say that. And then we could have that discussion. But I would hope that they care about climate change, because I think they should, in which case then the onus should be on giving us an alternative. The second thing is that most of the opponents of carbon pricing, well, many of them just think it doesn't work, right? And I think the evidence is, and the logic is actually pretty clear. If you're going to put a price on something, you are going to create a powerful incentive to do less of that thing. That's true for consumers. It's true for small businesses. It's true for big businesses. It's kind of just true for everybody. And again, back to the flexibility point, not everybody is going to respond in the same way. And certainly not everybody responds overnight. So a lot of people just say, well, how is a $50 carbon price going to reduce emissions quickly? Well, it's not going to reduce emissions quickly. It's going to reduce emissions gradually. But bit by bit, over 40 million Canadians, quarter by quarter, year by year, you get the emissions reductions. And that's happened in other jurisdictions. It is happening in Canada today. The third part is a lot of people, they don't like the carbon price. They dislike it in particular because of the belief that it is making life unaffordable, right? It is contributing to the affordability challenge in Canada today. But they choose to ignore the rebate, right? The a key part of carbon pricing in Canada today is that, you know, household, wherever the federal carbon price exists, so again, in all provinces other than BC and Quebec, people are getting rebates. And you know, roughly 80% of those households are getting rebates that dominate the amount they're paying in the carbon price. So it's only the upper 20% by income who are worse off financially. Okay, so I can understand why they don't like that. Okay, but the bottom 80%, which means the vast majority of Canadians, are getting more in the rebate. So they're not being challenged in terms of affordability. And you know, the work that we've seen actually from Trevor Toom and Jennifer Winter is that the effect of carbon pricing on overall inflation in the last couple of years has been minuscule. So that inflation is a complicated and fascinating thing. And if you want to have another podcast on the last 2 years of inflation, I'd be very happy to do that. Because the inflation in the last few years has been a fascinating combination of things. But the carbon price just isn't one of them.
If I could just follow up on that answer, Chris, I feel like I have to channel my father in Thunder Bay, who I think would argue that one of the problems with the carbon tax is that the substitutions for consumers aren't happening fast enough. And so the consequence for him is that he's forced to pay the tax because he can't switch his behavior as a consumer. What would you say to that argument?
Well, first of all, your father sounds like a smart and fine man. Look, I understand that concern. So an individual might say, I'd like to substitute to something else. I'd like to do something differently, but I don't know what to do, or maybe I just can't do it. And so for some things, that's going to be harder than for other things. I think we have to experience this over time and figure out how people respond. You know, my mother called me when I was running Ecofiscal. And well, you talked about your father, so I'm talking about my mom. Okay? And she was complaining because she was looking at her natural gas bill in Calgary. And she knew that I was involved in pushing for the carbon tax, and her natural gas bill now said, here's the carbon tax and there it is. And so she was saying, come on, like, Chris, I don't want to pay this. And I said, well, Mom, look, you don't have to pay this. If you don't want to, you can turn down the heat. And she said, I don't want to turn down the heat. And I said, well, Mom, you could turn down the heat and wear an extra sweater and then you'd save money. And she said, well, I don't want to turn down the heat and wear an extra sweater. And I said, that's okay, Mom, you don't have to. But then you have to pay the tax, but you have a choice. So, I mean, this is the situation we're all in, right? I might, you know, so I've got a Toyota Camry that's 11 years old, right? So next year or the next year, it's still in perfect shape. So, but one of these years soon, I'm going to buy a new car. I'd like to buy either an electric or a plug-in hybrid or something like that. But these are the decisions we make. We decide how to substitute. I recently swapped out an oil-burning furnace for an electric furnace, partly because of the emissions and the carbon price, and the electric furnace is just fabulous, right? But you make these decisions when they kind of present themselves, especially the big ones, the big investment decisions of swapping out a furnace or a new car. On a day-to-day basis, maybe your father is not going to change his behavior, or maybe he won't even notice how he's changing his behavior. But he will over time. So I actually think this kind of gets to the communications issue. I think the carbon price has not been well communicated and how it works and how people can respond. Because you don't want people to just feel like they are, I think people want to be part of this. And if people feel like, oh, I'm paying this tax, but I don't know what to do, then that can be incredibly frustrating. And I think politically damaging. So I think the government needs to do a better job on that. And frankly, they should have done a better job on that 4 years ago.
Hi, Hub Podcast listener. Fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. Thanks to growing government intervention into the news media, the next federal election will be covered mostly by journalists whose salaries will be majority funded by one form of public subsidy or another. Yes, you heard me right. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news and information consumers like you. And this is why The Hub will not be availing itself of these government subsidies. But producing high-quality independent news and analysis is expensive and time-consuming. And this is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Sign up now at thehub.ca.
What would you say to the argument that as the carbon tax currently plays a somewhat small role in Canada's emissions reductions, the political costs may outweigh the climate benefits? In other words, is there a political economy world in which if a government is not committed to carbon pricing as its principal climate policy tool, the cost-benefit test might change?
Yeah, I see that argument. I guess the thing that bothers me about that argument is that I think for political reasons, and I'm an economist, so you should take with a grain of salt anything I say that's about politics. But for political reasons, I see a benefit in all Canadians knowing that they are part of the solution. That we're all emitting, we're all part of the problem. Why shouldn't we all be part of the solution? And yes, I get the unpopularity of a very visible carbon tax, and we can come back and talk about the visibility of the carbon tax as perhaps its key liability, if you like.
Yes.
But I think there's something powerful about a policy that says, yeah, everybody is facing this. It's going to change behavior for all of us, maybe in different ways, but we're all part of the solution. I think it's wrong, by the way, completely wrong, to pretend that the large final emitters, the heavy industry, are actually the problem and we're not part of the problem. You know, I drive a car. It's part of the problem. I heat my house, well, formerly with home heating oil, I was part of the problem. Anybody else that has a natural gas furnace, part of the problem. We're all part of the problem, and we should all be part of the solution. So I guess I would prefer, rather than rolling up the carbon price because it's, you know, doing a small fraction of the total and it's divisive, I guess I would rather say, let's talk about it more and let's get us all on the same page to the point where we understand and we see why carbon pricing makes sense. You know, in 1988, there were a whole pile of Canadians who didn't think free trade made sense. I think free trade makes huge sense. And most Canadians, I think 35 years later, think it makes sense. So look, I think policy change takes a long time. And we are not yet at the point where carbon pricing is mainstream. I was probably naively optimistic several years ago that maybe it could be made mainstream within 10 years. Well, maybe it's going to take 20. But I think we shouldn't give up. I really don't.
Just in parentheses, to your point about the growing public acceptance of free trade, I think I saw a poll either late last week or early this week that showed that 85% of Canadians think that Ryan Mulroney's prime ministership was successful. And of course, in a lot of ways, that was defined by his work on the free trade file.
So there by the way, they didn't think that in 1995, right?
Indeed.
No, it's interesting. But you look back on Mulroney's economic legacy, just focus on the economics. It's astounding, actually, his economic legacy. I mean, there's lots to quibble about, I think, in other dimensions. But man, his economic legacy is powerful.
I'm not asking you to throw the towel in by any means. But as a rule of thumb exercise, if the Canadian government abandoned the carbon tax and had to fill the gap, so to speak, in its emission target, are there sufficient policy alternatives to get it there? And if so, what might some examples be?
Look, I think what you could do is you could design a set of sector by sector regulations. You could design a set of regulations for cement, a set of regulations for agriculture, a set of regulations for transportation, a set of regulations for steel, a set of regulations for, I don't know, something else. And that's complicated. It tends to be intrusive. And of course, it tends to be high cost. But you could do it. You could have a clean fuel standard, which the government, you know, is developing. You can make, by the way, Mark Jackard from SFU makes the argument that it's a false choice to think about just very high cost regulations versus a carbon price. You can make regulations more flexible by having compliance trading mechanisms in them. And he's quite right on this. But it's interesting that at its best, regulations that are super flexible still aren't quite as good as carbon pricing, right? They get close, but they're not quite as good. So you could do that, right? You could, I mean, look at the federal government has been giving lots of subsidies, right? So they're now playing sort of green industrial policy. Well, we could do that. Will that reduce emissions? Maybe. Will it be expensive? Almost certainly. And, you know, is that a good idea? I don't think that's a good idea, but it might actually reduce emissions. You can have ethanol blending mandates. Will it reduce emissions? Yes. Will it be expensive? Yes. And I guess my fear is that we can put in a lot of geeky, hard to detect, behind the scenes policies that may not generate the political backlash that the carbon price has generated. But at some point, it's going to become clear that, holy smokes, these things are costly. And at some point, doesn't that become evident? And then we say, well, we've introduced all these policies, you know, and by the way, we're in a world where our productivity growth, sucks, to be frank. Is that the world we want? So I don't think it is the world we want. So I back to my earlier comment that, you know, resources are scarce. We've got lots of challenges. We need to be mindful of our cost, the cost of all of our policies. So again, I would, the governments have alternatives, but carbon pricing is a pretty good one. Maybe Quebec is the answer, right? Quebec has a carbon price. It's a cap and trade system. And if you want to know what people argue about in Quebec, it isn't the cap and trade system. It's a complete non-issue. But is it driving up the price of gasoline in Quebec? Yes, it is. Are emissions falling? Yes, they are. And is it a political issue? No, it is not. So maybe that's all because it's a geeky, technical, complicated, behind-the-scenes system that nobody understands except those large players, effectively, that are in the carbon market. And you know, that when their costs get driven up because they have to buy expensive permits, they drive up the price of the things they're selling, like the gasoline, but consumers don't see it. So maybe that's the secret here.
If you'll permit me just to make two observations in response to your comments, Chris. The first is on your point about visibility of climate policies and the potential lag for a political reaction, I think of the province of Ontario, where I think one can argue rising energy costs, you know, ultimately cost the Liberal government an election in 2018. And that was primarily because those cost increases hadn't been politically socialized, were not visible. And so when they bit, people weren't prepared and reacted viscerally. So they may have, in other words, they may have concealed the costs for some time, but eventually it caught up to them. The second observation I make, and incidentally, this is something I think I produced for the Ecofiscal Commission, but I don't know if it ever saw the light of day before it wound down after a tremendous run. And that is something of a criticism of carbon tax proponents, that in the analysis of the economic costs, it seems to me that proponents have underestimated the relative savings in terms of the size of government itself. You know, as you were outlining a possible sectoral regulation strategy, I thought about the teams of public servants within the Department of Environment that would be required to first develop and then ultimately carry out such an agenda. And so in a way, the estimated cost of a carbon tax almost underestimate the relative benefits to these other models, because in theory, they don't require the same government footprint in terms of implementation.
So I think that's a good point. And I would like to believe it's true, and maybe it is true. Okay. But let me give you one complication. And it comes down to the industrial carbon pricing system, because that is a lot more complicated than the consumer carbon pricing system. Because what it's effectively doing is that it's facing you know, large final emitters with a carbon price, but it's also effectively giving them the equivalent of a financial subsidy based on their output. And the net result is that they have incentives to reduce their carbon intensity of their output. All of that is designed to protect their competitiveness. And so the calibration, the design and calibration of that system is complicated, and it requires a lot of those civil servants, you know, digging into details. So it's not as if carbon pricing requires, you know, a super small government bureaucracy and regulations are super big and there's nothing in between. If the carbon price is more complicated, and BC, by the way, when BC introduced its carbon tax, they didn't have that industrial carbon price system because their emissions intensive trade exposed sector was really small. But in Alberta, it's big. In Ontario, you know, in Ontario, it's small, but it's big in absolute terms, small as a share of total. But in Alberta and Saskatchewan, it's huge. So anyways, the federal carbon price has that thing, that output-based pricing system for the large final emitters. It's complicated. It does require some resources. But I still kind of agree with your belief, your statement, that if you are going to go sector by sector regulations, invariably you're going to be spending a whole bunch of effort designing those. And we should think about those costs for sure.
Taking for granted that any emissions abatement approach will have economic costs, what is the order of magnitude difference between maintaining the carbon tax and some of these other alternatives that you've outlined?
Right. So the final report that Ecofiscal did in the fall of 2019 ran a horse race between three policy packages. Okay. One policy package was pretty much what the federal government is doing now. It was a carbon price that was rising actually to about $200 a ton, so a little bit beyond the current one, and full rebates. Okay. The second package was not carbon pricing, but economy-wide regulations and subsidies. And then the third package was regulations and subsidies, but only focused on heavy industry. And these three packages, we modeled them and we calibrated them so that they all achieved the 2030 targets. And they all could achieve the 2030 targets, but they did it at a different cost. And the cost was measured by the effect on per capita GDP. And the difference, so the carbon pricing one was the better path. It was a rising path for per capita GDP. The second one, the economy-wide regulations and subsidies, was still a rising path of GDP per capita, but lower. And the industrially focused regulations and subsidies actually started to decline. Okay. The difference between the best and the worst was $3,000 in 2015 dollars per person. $3,000 per person. So a family of four or three or four is $10,000 to $12,000 per capita GDP, right? They were per family GDP. That's a big difference. That's a big cost difference. So again, I mean, the whole point of that paper was to say, if you don't want a carbon price, you don't have to carbon price. There are alternatives. But the other alternatives, and by the way, those packages, the industrially focused regulations and subsidies, was what was being talked about at the time by Jason Kenney and Doug Ford. Right? And so, you know, the argument is you don't want to use carbon pricing. That's fine. You got to use something. And what are you going to use? And again, you know, you can come back to the argument that politically, it might be easier to do the less visible high cost policies, but I'm not sure how long that is going to last. At some point, that may come back to bite you.
May I slide in a penultimate question that I wasn't going to put to you, but as we discuss a possible mix of policies to substitute for the carbon tax, I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't at least get your reaction. As you probably know, there's been growing conversations in policy circles in and around Ottawa about possibly invoking Article 6 of the Paris Agreement to, in effect, get credit for Canada's contribution to global emissions reductions based on our exports of relatively lower emitting energy sources to countries that rely on heavier emitting energy sources, or possibly even entering into some type of bilateral or multilateral agreements in which importing countries are prepared to share some of the emissions reduction with energy exporters. Do you find any of those conversations credible, or are those mostly wishful thinking on the part of politicians and policymakers?
Yeah, my sense is that it's wishful thinking, but it leads to an interesting other observation. So in my view, you know, let's suppose Canada started exporting LNG to China, right? This is the one we often hear about. Oh, why don't we export LNG to China? That will displace some coal-fired electricity plants that they're currently building, you know, building quickly. And that's going to help them reduce their emissions. And that's a really important source of global emissions. So isn't that good? Number one, yes, that would be great. We should do it, right? If the Chinese want to buy our LNG, we should do it. Should we get credit for it in an emissions sense? Well, no, I don't think so. I think China will get credit because Chinese emissions will fall because they will stop using some coal and they'll use LNG instead, and that will be an emissions reduction. Where does Canada get the credit? Canada gets the credit through the marketplace. We get the credit because since China wants to do that, they want to buy our LNG. That increases the demand for our LNG. They're going to give us money for our LNG, and that's the credit we get. I don't think we should get or deserve an emissions credit, but I do think we get the dollar credit. But here's the interesting observation that leads to. Let's suppose that we started doing this, and you could argue that it would increase emissions in Canada, right? LNG production is emissions intensive.
Yes.
It might increase emissions in Canada, but reduce emissions by more in China. So globally, that transaction would be a winner, right? That would actually reduce global emissions. So the world should say, we want that to happen. Now, here's back to the very first question about Canada's focus on its targets. If it makes sense globally for Canada to export LNG to China, that might blow us past our 2030 targets. So maybe our 2030 targets don't make a huge amount of sense globally. So that's a tough conversation, right? Because now, then that kind of gets you to point, well, how do we get our 2030 targets, right? And where do they come from? And, you know, maybe we shouldn't have those 2030 targets, right? If in fact we could expand our LNG and reduce China's emissions, it's okay if Canada's emissions go up by 10 megatons, but China's go down by 20 as a result of this transaction. That's got to be a good thing. Let's make that happen. I don't think we require any international coordination to make that happen. We just require a market to make that happen. But we would require domestically somebody to say, you know what? Maybe in a world where Canada exports LNG, maybe that 2030 target wasn't so smart. Yeah, that's a tough conversation.
Well, let's wrap up with a final tough conversation. If a government wanted to try to preserve the carbon tax, but be responsive to public concerns, are there any adjustments or reforms that it might consider in your mind?
Well, so this is the cheap one, the easy one, is that, you know, one adjustment is let's explain it a lot better. Right. I mean, one of the complaints is people think, and I understand why they think this, that, you know, it makes no sense to tax with one hand and give a rebate back with the other. It just looks like we're batshit crazy. Right. So, I mean, people are saying, wow, you got way too many economists in Ottawa. Don't listen to Reagan. Right. This is crazy. And so the government's got to explain that because it actually does make sense. But they got to explain that, and they got to get Canadians to kind of get their head around that. And that's not easy. But maybe the rebates play another role. You know, back in October, when the federal government carved out the exemption for the home heating fuel in response to pressure from Atlantic MPs, like, I thought that was just a huge mistake. And it took, what, 2.5 minutes before it opened up calls from Danielle Smith and Scott Moe, who were quite right in their complaints, that all of a sudden you've created this exemption, and you've created an unfairness that wasn't there before. They were right. And I'm not used to saying that. They were absolutely right in those complaints. And so the government, I think, created a problem for itself. They could have just increased the rebate temporarily. And given, you know, the inflation that we've had over the past couple of years, I could actually see an argument for saying, you know what, we're just going to increase the rebate. In fact, the federal government introduced a grocery rebate last year or 2 years ago, right? You could have done the same sort of thing. Way better than to delay or cancel the carbon price is to say, we're going to just increase the rebate by a couple of $100 per person for a year or for 2 years because everybody's got some affordability issues. Okay, let's have that debate. Let's think about that. But I actually think, again, I am perhaps being naively optimistic that, you know, Canadians want action on climate change. I think they can be brought around, I guess, on this issue. But what it requires is a legitimate, honest, open debate, not just about carbon pricing, but about what are the alternatives to carbon pricing. Because if it's carbon pricing or nothing, that's not really a fair debate, because the nothing means, oh, I guess we're going to do nothing about climate change. So let's have a fair debate, which is carbon pricing versus regulations versus subsidies, you know, versus, I don't know, something else, if you got something else in your back pocket. But let's actually compare policies that can do the same job. And I just don't feel like that has been debated well enough, thoroughly enough, honestly enough. You know, and political strategists might say, look, Chris, you lost the debate after 30 seconds if you can't, you know, convince people, or maybe 10 seconds, I don't know. But you're very good to listen to me for so long.
Well, for those Canadians who prepare to go deeper and want to understand these issues, they've benefited greatly from this conversation, as I know I have. Chris Reagan, founding director of the Max Bell School of Public Policy at McGill University, thank you so much for joining us at Hub Dialogues.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Hub Dialogues, brought to you by Hub Canada Media. Visit www.thehub.ca for daily analysis and insights into the big issues and ideas driving the public conversation. Thehub.ca gives you access to our original news reporting and the thinking of the Hub's best writers, including Sean Spear. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you will receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was, along with all kinds of other terrific benefits. The host of today's program was Sean Spear, the Hub's editor at large. This episode was produced by Amal Atter-Guzman. The Hub's audio producers are Alex Glutch and David Matta.